The day was warm and drowsy with the bee murmur and the smell of the blossoms from the peach orchards. He climbed the terraces and rested at the crest, for he found he was breathless and shaky. Months in hospital had left him unaccustomed to walking far, but it was not that alone. The episode with the child had distressed him terribly. He looked longingly towards the sky. It was clear and brilliant blue, with high silver cloud in the north. He wished he could ascend beyond those clouds. He knew he would find peace up there. A taxi dropped him off at the top of Malik Street. The front door was unlocked, swinging open before he could fit his key to the lock. Puzzled and alarmed, he stepped into the living room. It was as if he had left it so many months before, but somebody had cleaned and swept, and there were fresh flowers in a vase upon the olive wood table. A huge bouquet of gaily coloured dahlias, yellow and scarlet. David smelled food, hot and spicy and tantalising after the bland hospital fare. "Hello," he called. "Who's there?" "Welcome home," there was a familiar bellow from behind the closed bathroom door. "I didn't expect you so soon, and you've caught me with my skirts up and pants down." There was a scuffling sound, and then the toilet flushed thunderously and the door was flung open. Ella Kadesh appeared majestically through it. She wore one of her huge kaftans. It was a blaze of primary colours. Her hat was apple green in colour, the brim pinned up at the side like an Australian bush hat by an enormous jade brooch and a bunch of ostrich feathers. Her heavy arms were flung wide in a gesture of welcome, and the face was split in a huge grin of anticipation. She came towards him, and the grin persisted long after the horror had dawned in her bright little eyes. Her steps slowed. "David?" Her voice was uncertain. "It is you, David." "Hello, Ella." "Oh, God." "Oh, sweet holy name of God, what have they done to you, my beautiful young Mars?" "Listen, you old bag," he said harshly. "If you start blubbering, I'm going to throw you down the steps." She made a huge effort to control it, fighting back the tears that flooded into her eyes. But her jowls wobbled and her voice was thick and nasal as she enfolded him in her huge arms and hugged him to her bosom. "I've got a case of cold beers in the refrigerator, and I made a pot of curry for us. You'll love my curry. It's the thing I do best." David ate with enormous appetite, washing down the fiery food with cold beer, and he listened to Ella talk. She spouted words like a fountain, using their flow to cover her pity and embarrassment. "They would not let me visit you, but I telephoned every week and kept in touch that way. The sister and I got very friendly, and she let me know you were coming today, so I drove up to make sure you had a welcome." She tried to avoid looking directly at his face, but when she did, the shadows appeared in her eyes, even though she made a convincing effort at gaiety. When he finished eating at last, she asked, "What will you do now, David?" "I would have liked to go back and fly. It's the thing I like to do best. But they've forced me to resign my commission. I disobeyed orders. Joe and I followed them across the border, and they don't want me anymore." "It was nearly open war, David. It was a crazy thing that you and Joe did." David nodded. "I was mad. I wasn't thinking straight that day, after Deborah..." Ella interrupted quickly. "Yes, I know. Share another beer?" David nodded distractedly. "How is she, Ella?" It was the question he had wanted to ask all along. "She's just fine, Davy. She's begun the new book, and if anything, it's better than the first. I think she'll become a very important writer." "Her eyes? Is there any improvement?" Ella shook her head. "She's come to terms with that now. Doesn't seem to bother her any longer. Just as you will come to accept what has happened." David was not listening. "Ella, in all that time when I was in hospital, every day I hoped, I knew it was useless, but I hoped to hear from her, a card, a word." "She didn't know, Davy." "Didn't know?" David demanded, and leaned across the table to grip Ella's wrist. "What do you mean?" "After Joe was killed, Deborah's father was very angry. He believed that you were responsible." David nodded, the blank mask of his face concealing his guilt. "Well, he told Deborah that you had left Israel and gone back to your home. We were all sworn to silence. And that's what Deborah believes now." David released Ella's wrist, picked up his beer glass, and sipped at the head of froth. You still haven't answered my question, David. What are you going to do now? I don't know, Ella. I guess I'll have to think about that. A harsh, warm wind came off the hills and ruffled the surface of the lake, darkening it to black and flecking it with white crests. The fishing boats along the curve of the shore tugged restlessly at their mooring ropes, and the fishing nets upon their drying racks billowed like bridal veils. The wind caught Deborah's hair and shook it out in a loose cloud. It pressed the silk dress she wore against her body, emphasizing the heavy roundness of her breasts and the length of her legs. She stood on the battlements of the Crusader castle, leaning both hands lightly on the head of her cane, and she stared out across the water, almost as though she could see beyond it. Ella sat near her, on a fallen block of masonry out of the wind. But she pinned her hat down with one hand as she spoke, watching Deborah's face intently to judge her reactions. At the time, it seemed the kindest thing to do. I agreed to keep the truth from you because I did not want you to torture yourself, Deborah spoke sharply. Don't ever do that again. Ella made a mow of resignation and went on. I had no way of knowing how bad he was. They would not let me see him, and so I suppose I was a coward and I let it drift. Deborah shook her head angrily, but she remained silent. Ella wondered again that sightless eyes could contain so much expression, for Deborah's emotions blazed clearly in the honey-colored sparks as she turned her head towards Ella. It was not the time to distract you, don't you see, my dear? You were adjusting so nicely, working so well on your book. I did not see that we could gain anything by telling you. I decided to cooperate with your father and see how things turned out later. Then why are you telling me all this now? Deborah demanded. What has happened to change your mind? What has happened to David? Yesterday at noon, David was discharged from Hadassah Hospital. Hospital? Deborah was puzzled. You don't mean that he's been in hospital all this time, Ella? 9 months? It's impossible.
It's the truth.
He must have been terribly hurt. Deborah's anger had changed to concern. How is he, Ella? What happened? Is he healed now?
Ella was silent a moment, and Deborah took a pace towards her.
Well? She asked.
David's plane flamed out, and he was very badly burned about the head. He has recovered completely now. His burns have healed, but...
Ella hesitated again, and Deborah groped for her hand and found it.
Go on, Ella.
But?
David is no longer the most beautiful man I have ever seen.
I don't understand.
He is no longer swift and vital, and any woman who sees him now will find it difficult to be near him, let alone love him.
Deborah was listening intently, her expression rapt and her eyes soft-focused.
He is very conscious of the way he looks now. He is searching for some place to hide, I think. He talks of wanting to fly as though it was some form of escape. He knows he is alone now, cut off from the world by the mask he wears.
Deborah's eyes had missed it, and Ella made her gravelly voice gentler, and she went on.
But there is somebody who will never see that mask. Ella drew the girl closer to her. Somebody who remembers only the way he was before.
Deborah's grip tightened on Ella's hand, and she began to smile.
It was an expression that seemed to radiate from deep within her.
He needs you now, Deborah, Ella said softly. That is all there is left for him. Will you change your decision now?
Fetch him to me, Ella, Deborah's voice shook. Fetch him to me as soon as you can.
David climbed the long line of steps towards Ella's studio. It was a day of bright sunlight, and he wore open sandals and light silk slacks of a bronze color and a short-sleeved shirt with a wide V-neck. His arms were pale from lack of sun, the dark hair of his chest contrasting strongly against the soft cream, and upon his head he wore a wide-brimmed white straw hat to guard the cicatrice from the sun and to soften his face with shadow. He paused, and he could feel the break of sweat under the shirt and the pumping of his lungs. He despised the weakness of his body and the quivering of his legs as he came out on the terrace. It was deserted, and he crossed to the shuttered doors and went into the gloom. Ella Kadesh, sitting on a Samarkand carpet in the center of the paved floor, was an astonishing sight. For she was dressed in a brief bikini costume adorned with pink roses that almost disappeared under the rolls of ponderous flesh that hung over it from belly and breast. He was in the yoga position of Padmasana, the sitting lotus, and her massive legs were twisted and entwined like mating pythons. Her hands were held before her, palm to palm, and her eyes were closed in meditation. Upon her head, her ginger wig was set foursquare like that of a judge. David leaned in the doorway, and before he could recover his breath, he began to laugh. It began as a wheezy little chuckle, and then suddenly he was really laughing from deep down, great gusts of it that shook his helpless body and flogged his lungs. It was not mirth, but a catharsis of the last dregs of suffering. It was the moment of accepting life again, a taking up once more of the challenge of living. Ella must have recognized it as such, for she did not move, squatting like some cheerful Buddha on the brilliant carpet, and she opened one little eye. The effect was even more startlingly comic, and David reeled away from the door and fell into one of the chairs. "Your soul is a desert, David Morgan," said Ella. "You have no recognition of beauty. All loveliness would wither on the dung heap, which..." But the rest of it was lost as she also began to giggle, and the yoga pose broke down, melting like a jelly on a hot day, and she traded him hoot for hoot and bellow for bellow of laughter. "I'm stuck," she gasped at last. "Help me, Davy, you oaf." And he staggered to her, knelt and struggled to help her unlock her interwoven legs. They came apart with little creaking and popping sounds, and Ella collapsed face down on the carpet, groaning and giggling at the same time. "Oh, get out of here," she moaned. "Leave me to die in peace. Go and find your woman. She's down on the jetty." She watched him go quickly, and then she dragged herself up and went to the door. The laughter dried up, and she whispered aloud, "My two poor little crippled kittens. I wonder if I've done the right thing." The shadows of doubt crossed her face and then faded. "Well, it's too damn late for worry now. Kadesh, you interfering old bag. You should have thought about that before." A gaudily coloured towel and beach jacket was spread upon the jetty, and a transistor radio, with its volume turned high, blared out a heavy rock tune. Far out in the bay, Deborah was swimming alone, a steady, powerful overarm crawl. Her brown arms flashed wetly in the sun at each stroke, and the water churned to froth at the beat of her legs. She stopped to tread water. Her bathing cap was plain white, and he could see that she was listening for the sound of the radio, for she began to swim again, heading directly in towards the jetty. She came out of the water, pulling off the cap and shaking out her hair. Her body was dark, sun-browned and bejeweled with drops. The muscles looked firm and hard, and her tread was confident and sure as she came up the stone steps and picked up her towel. As she dried herself, David stood near and watched her avidly, seeming to devour her with his eyes, trying to make up in that first minute for all those many months. He had pictured her so clearly, and yet there was much he had forgotten. Her hair was softer, cloudier than he remembered. He had forgotten the plasticity and luster of her skin. It was darker also than it had been before, almost the colour of her eyes. She must have spent many hours each day in the sun. Suddenly and unaffectedly, she threw her towel down and adjusted the top of her brief costume, pulling open the thin fabric and cupping one fat breast in her hand to settle it more comfortably. David felt his need for her so strongly that it seemed he could not contain it all within the physical bounds of his chest. He moved slightly, and the gravel crunched softly under his shoes. Instantly, the lovely head turned towards him and froze in the attitude of listening. The eyes were wide open, intelligent and expressive. They seemed to look slightly to one side of him, and David had a powerful impulse to turn and glance behind him, following their steady gaze. "David?" she asked softly. "Is that you, David?" He tried to answer her, but his voice failed him, and his reply was a small choking sound. She ran to him swiftly and long-legged as a roused foal, with her arms reaching out and her face lighting with joy. He caught her up, and she clung to him fiercely, almost angrily, as though she had been too long denied. I've missed you, David. Her voice was fierce also. Oh, God, you'll never know how much I've missed you. And she pressed her mouth to the stark gash in his mask of flesh. This was the first human being who had treated him without reserve, without pity or revulsion in all those months, and David felt his heart swell harder, and his embrace was as fierce as hers. She broke at last, leaning back to press her hips unashamedly against his, exulting in the hard thrustingness of his arousal, proud to have evoked it, and quickly, questioningly, she ran her hands over his face, feeling the new contours and the unexpected planes and angles. She felt him begin to pull away, but she stopped him and continued her examination. My fingers tell me that you are still beautiful. You have lying fingers, he whispered. But she ignored his words and pushed forward teasingly with her hips. And I'm getting another very powerful message from further south. She gave a breathless little laugh. Come with me, please, sir. Holding his hand, she ran lightly up the steps, dragging him after her. He was amazed at the agility and confidence with which she negotiated the climb. She drew him into the cottage, and as he looked about him, quickly taking it all in, she closed and bolted the door. Immediately the room was cool and dim and intimate. On the bed, her body was still damp and cold from the lake, but her lips were hot as she strained against him urgently. The two beautiful young bodies meshed hungrily, almost as if they were attempting to find sanctuary within each other. Desperately flesh sought haven within flesh, within each other's encircling arms and legs, they searched for and found surcease from the loneliness and the darkness. The physical act of love, no matter how often repeated, was insufficient for their needs. Even in the intervals between, they clung desperately to each other, sleeping pressed together. They groped drowsily but anxiously for each other if the movements of sleep separated them for even an instant. They talked, holding hands. She reached up to touch his face at intervals, he staring into her golden eyes. Even when she prepared their simple meals, he stood close beside or behind her so that she could sway against him and feel him there. It was as though they lived in momentary dread of being once more separated. It was 2 days before they left the sanctuary of the cottage and walked together along the lake shore, or swam from the jetty and lay in the warm sun. But even when Ella looked down at them from the terrace and waved, David asked, "Shall we go up to her?" "No," Deborah answered quickly, "not yet. I'm not ready to share you with anybody else yet. Just a little while more, please, David." And it was another 3 days before they climbed the path to the studio. Ella had laid on one of her gargantuan lunches, but she had invited no other guests, and they were grateful to her for that. "I thought I'd have to send down a party of stretcher-bearers to carry you up, Davy," Ella greeted him with a lecherous chuckle. "Don't be crude, Ella," Deborah told her primly, flushing to a dark rose-brown, and Ella let fly with one of her explosive bursts of mirth that was so contagious they must follow it. They sat beneath the palm trees and drank wine from the earthenware jugs, and ate hugely, laughing and talking without restraint, David and Deborah so involved with each other that they were not aware of Ella's shrewdly veiled appraisal. The change in Deborah was dramatic. All the coolness and reserve were gone now. The armor in which she had clad her emotions was stripped away. She was vital and eager and blooming with love. She sat close beside David, laughing with delight at his sallies, and leaning to touch and caress him, as though to reassure herself of his presence. Ella glanced again at David, trying to smile naturally at him, but guiltily aware of the sneaking sensation of repulsion she still felt, repulsion and aching pity, when she looked at that monstrous head. She knew that if she saw it every day for 20 years, it would still disturb her. Deborah laughed again at something David had said, and turned her face to him, offering her mouth with a touching innocence. "What a terrible thing to say," she laughed. "I think a gesture of contrition is called for," and responded eagerly as the great ravaged head bent to her and the thin slit of a mouth touched hers. It was disquieting to see the lovely dark face against that mask of ruined flesh, and yet it was also strangely moving. It was the right thing.
For once I did the right thing, Ella decided, watching them and feeling a vague envy. These two are bound together completely, made strong by their separate afflictions. Before, it had been a mutual itching of the flesh, a chance spark struck from two minds meeting. But now it was something that transcended that. Ella recalled regretfully a long line of lovers stretching back to the shadowy edges of her memory, receding images which seemed unreal now. If only there had been something to bind her to one of those. If only she had been left with something more valuable than half-remembered words and faded memories of brief mountings and furtive couplings. She sighed, and they looked to her questioningly. A sad sound, Ella, darling, Deborah said. We are selfish. Please forgive us. Not sad, my children, Ella denied hotly, scattering the old phantoms of her memory. I'm happy for you. You have something very wonderful, strong and bright and wonderful. Protect it as you would your life. She took up her wine glass. I give you a toast. I give you David and Deborah, and a love made invincible by suffering. And they were serious for a moment while they drank the toast together, in golden yellow wine, sitting in golden yellow sunlight. Then the mood resumed, and they were gay once more. Once the first desperate demands of their bodies had been met, once they had drawn as close together as physical limits would allow, then they began a coupling of the spirit. They had never really spoken before, even when they had shared the house on Malik Street. They had used only the superficial word symbols. Now they began learning really to talk. Some nights they did not sleep, but spent the fleeting hours of darkness in exploring each other's minds and bodies, and they delighted to realize that this exploration would never be completed, for the areas of their minds were boundless. During the day, the blind girl taught David to see. He found that he had never truly used his eyes before, and now that he must see for both of them, he had to learn to make the fullest use of his sight. He must learn to describe color and shape and movement accurately and incisively, for Deborah's demands were insatiable. In turn, David, whose own confidence had been shattered by his disfigurement, taught confidence to the girl. She learned to trust him implicitly as he grew to anticipate her needs. She learned to step out boldly beside him, knowing that he would guide or caution her with a light touch or a word. Her world had shrunk to the small area about the cottage and jetty within which she could find her way surely. Now, with David beside her, her frontiers fell back and she was free to move wherever she chose. Yet they ventured out together only cautiously at first, wandering along the lakeside together or climbing the hills towards Nazareth, and each day they swam in the green lake waters, and each night they made love in the curtained alcove. David grew hard and lean and suntanned again, and it seemed they were complete, for when Ella asked, Deborah, when are you going to make a start on the new book? She laughed and answered lightly, oh, sometime within the next 100 years. A week later, she asked of David, this time, have you decided what you're going to do yet, Davy? Just what I'm doing now, he said, and Deborah backed him up quickly. Forever, she said, just like this, forever. Then, without thinking about it, without really steeling themselves to it, they went to where they would meet other people in the mass. David borrowed the speedboat, picked up a shopping list from Ella, and they planed down along the lake shore to Tiberias, with the white wake churning out behind them and the wind and drops of spray in their faces. They moored in the tiny harbour of the marina at Lido Beach and walked up into the town. David was so engrossed with Deborah that the crowds about him were unreal, and although he noticed a few curious glances, they meant very little to him. Although it was early in the season, the town was filled with visitors, and the buses were parked in the square at the foot of the hill and along the lakefront, for this was full on the tourist route. David carried a plastic bag that grew steadily heavier until it was ready to overflow. Bread, and that's the lot, Deborah mentally ticked off the list. They went down the hill under the eucalyptus trees and found a table on the harbour wall beneath a gaily coloured umbrella. They sat touching each other and drank cold beer and ate pistachio nuts, oblivious of everything and anybody about them, even though the other tables were crowded with tourists. The lake sparkled, and the softly rounded hills seem very close in the bright light. Once a flight of phantoms went booming down the valley, flying low on some mysterious errand, and David watched them dwindle southward without regrets. When the sun was low, they went to where the speedboat was moored, and David handed Deborah down into it. On the wall above them sat a party of tourists, probably on some package deal pilgrimage, and they were talking animatedly. Their accents were Limehouse, Golders Green, and Merseyside, although the subtleties of pronunciation were lost on David. He started the motor and pushed off from the wall, steering for the harbour mouth, with Deborah sitting close beside him and the motor burbling softly. A big red-faced tourist looked down from the wall, and supposing that the motor covered his voice, nudged his wife. "Oh, get a look at those two, Mavis. Beauty and the Beast, isn't it? Cork it, Bert. They might understand." "Ah, go on, love. They only talk Yiddish or whatever." Deborah felt David's arm go rigid under her hand, felt him begin to pull away, sensing his outrage and anger. But she gripped his forearm tightly and restrained him. "Let's go, Davy, darling. Leave them, please." Even when they were alone in the safety of the cottage, David was silent, and she could feel the tension in his body, and the air was charged with it. They ate the evening meal of bread and cheese and fish and figs in the same strained silence. Deborah could think of nothing to say to distract him, for the careless words had wounded her as deeply. Afterwards she lay unsleeping beside him. He lay on his back, not touching her, with his arms at his sides and his fists clenched. When at last she could bear it no longer, she turned to him and stroked his face, still not knowing what to say. It was David who broke the silence at last. "I want to go away from people. We don't need people, do we?" "No," she whispered. "We don't need them." "There's a place called Jabulani. It's deep in the African bushveld, far from the nearest town. My father bought it as a hunting lodge 30 years ago, and now it belongs to me." "Tell me about it." Deborah laid her head on his chest, and he began stroking her hair, relaxing as he talked. "There's a wide plain on which grow open forests of mapani and mahubahuba, with some big fat old baobabs and a few ivory palms. In the open glades, the grass is yellow gold and the fronds of the alala palms look like beggar's fingers. At the end of a plain is a line of hills. They turn blue at a distance, and the peaks are shaped like the turrets of a fairy castle with tumbled blocks of granite. Between the hills rises a spring of water, a strong spring that has never dried, and the water's very clear and sweet." "What does Jabulani mean?" Deborah asked when he had described it to her. "It means the place of rejoicing," David told her. "I want to go there with you," she said. "What about Israel?" he asked. "Will you not miss it?" "No," she shook her head. "You see, I will take it with me in my heart." Ella went up to Jerusalem with them, filling the back seat of the Mercedes. She would help Deborah select the furniture they would take with them from the house and have it crated and shipped. The rest of it she would sell for them. Aaron Cohen would negotiate the sale of the house, and both David and Deborah felt a chill of sadness at the thought of other people living in their home. David left the women at it, and he drove out to Ain Karim and parked the Mercedes beside the iron gate in the garden wall. The brig was waiting for him in that bleak and forbidding room above the courtyard. When David greeted him from the doorway, he looked up coldly, and there was no relaxation of the iron features, no warmth or pity in the fierce warrior eyes. "You come to me with the blood of my son upon your hands," he said, and David froze at the words and held his gaze. After a few moments, the brig indicated the tall back chair against the far wall, and David crossed stiffly to it and sat down. "If you had suffered less, I would have made you answer for more," said the brig. "But vengeance and hatred are barren things, as you have discovered." David dropped his eyes to the floor. "I will not pursue them further, despite the dictates of my heart, for that is what I am condemning in you. You are a violent young man, and violence is the pleasure of fools and only the last resort of wise men. The only excuse for it is to protect what is rightfully yours. Any other display of violence is abuse. You abused the power I gave you, and in doing it, you killed my son and brought my country to the verge of war. The Brig stood up from his desk, and he crossed to the window and looked down into the garden. They were both silent while he stroked his moustache and remembered his son. At last, the Brig sighed heavily and turned back into the room. "Why do you come to me?" he asked. "I wish to marry your daughter, sir." "You are asking me or telling me?" the Brig demanded, and then, without waiting for an answer, returned to his desk and sat down. "If you abuse this also, if you bring her pain or unhappiness, I will seek you out. Depend upon it." David stood up and settled the cloth cap over his gross head, pulling the brim well down. "We'd like you to be at the wedding. Deborah asked that particularly, for you and her mother." The Brig nodded. "You may tell her that we will be there."